Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program, rising power costs threaten South Africa's fragile recovery. South Africans splash R1 billion abroad in just 6 months. Brace for a stormy summer as the South African Weather Service issues an early warning, and police suicides surge and urgent calls to confront the first responder mental health crisis grow. It's Wednesday, the 22nd of October. South Africa's rising electricity prices have pushed the country to the brink of what COSATU is calling today a jobs bloodbath. Tariffs have soared since 2006, hammering energy-intensive industries like smelters. What's the upshot of that? Well, it puts thousands of jobs on the line. Congress of South African Trade Unions is now demanding immediate government intervention, warning that if nothing changes, factories will close. If they're not already, communities will be devastated, and that even strike action is inevitable. COSATU's parliamentary coordinator is Matthew Parks, and he joins me now. Matthew, welcome to you. You've called this a jobs bloodbath. How severe is the crisis then in real numbers, and what jobs are at risk?
Thanks for having us. We think it's devastating, but also to bear in mind that we have an unemployment rate of 43%. We've been sitting at 1% economic growth for the past two decades. We just can't afford to add more people to unemployment queue. But the research we've seen, the stats we've seen from industry, shows that we've lost about 350,000 jobs because of the increasing unaffordable price of electricity, especially the impact upon the industrial sectors, and in particular the smelters. We've been engaging with Glencore over the past year. What they've shown to us, or what other companies in the sector have shown to us, it really is a jobs bloodbath. They've closed about half of the smelters. These are largely in rural towns, so that also has a double impact upon an already kind of very limited economic base job opportunities for those communities. And they tried their level best to keep those workers on board, but any company has to have cash flow to maintain cash output, being paid to salaries, etc. So I think for us, we've been raising this for a while. Since 2006, when load shedding first entered our vocabulary, electricity prices are estimated to have gone up by over 500%. And there's no wages which have gone up by that rate. There's no amount of economic growth that has gone up by that rate. And so that really is not just a question of those jobs that we've shed, but also those jobs that we could never have created because we've made electricity unaffordable. If you compare the price of electricity in South Africa to that of China or other industrial economies, we're about four times the rate of electricity in terms of prices. So for us, again, that's another crisis we've got to address. We have been pleasantly heartened, so to speak, by the Minister for Electricity, Dr. Ramakgopa's commitments to finding a solution to reduce the price of electricity, especially for the heavy intensive users. We think that needs to be done quickly. And I think there has been a lot of discussions, been meetings with industry, we've had meetings at NEDLAC to say, can we get something in place by December? That may come in the form of, reduced electricity tariffs or rebates, etc. Longer term, you do need to deal with the fundamental leakages, which causes Eskom to be dependent upon these double-digit tariff hikes. And that's because, half the customers pay as prepaid, and other half pay when they feel like it. And that's not a sustainable economic model. No company could sustain that.
Matthew, you talk about being heartened, all well and good, but do you really believe the state at this point has the political will to act decisively on Eskom? And you're talking about the end of the year when it comes to pricing, or maybe just another promise without material delivery?
Look, we have the same skepticism born by years of disappointment. We hope they can do so. If they don't do so, the consequences will be devastating, not just for the employees of Glencore or for the families of the communities, but even the economy at large, the industrial backbone. We're seeing the impact upon many manufacturing plants, many factories. It's something you just can't continue to kick the can down the road. So we want to believe that something can be done, and it needs to be done. I think the shorter-term interventions are perhaps the easier ones, that you can come with some sort of different tariff regime. And there has been lots of engagement and discussion between the ministry, Eskom, industry, and so on. I think the more complex one is a longer-term solution, because you can put in place a temporary 6-month, 24-month for example, plan to say you reduce it by this amount, etc., or we give you this types of tax rebates, for example. But you ultimately need to deal with the financial leakages. If you look at the past 5 years, municipal debt owed to Eskom has more than doubled from about 40 billion rand to 95 billion rand just in 5 years. And that just shows you how vulnerable we are to it. So you've got to deal with the hard issues. And that is the much more difficult
Sure.
type of work, which is moving everybody to prepaid.
I take your point on cutting tariffs, but I would suggest to you that it's a big demand. How do you see that being financed in a fiscally constrained environment such as exists right now?
A difficult one, and you're right, because if you cut rebates, how do you plug the hole at Eskom? If you give tax rebates through Treasury, where do you then massage the book, so to speak, going elsewhere? But I think we also had to look at the longer term implication. Yes, there'll be a hit in terms of tax revenue or in terms of electricity revenue in the short space, but in the longer term, you'll save these industries, you'll save these jobs in these local communities. And I think we've got to take a longer approach. But also, to be fair to industry, to be fair to society, it's not society or industry who said we must mismanage Eskom, we must neglect infrastructure investments, and so forth. The state isn't innocent in this regard. In fact, to be honest, they are largely to blame with the corrupt elements who came on board. So we don't have a choice. We're seeing many other industries, including the motor manufacturing sector, the clothing industry, really vulnerable to this issue. Similar with the mining sector. So if you don't deal with the longer term vision, you're not going to resolve it. So I think for us, we don't have a luxury of choosing whether or not to do it. We have to do it.
So a bitter pill to swallow for all parties concerned, I'd suggest. So is COSATU then prepared to support alternative solutions, maybe downsizing Eskom or even attracting private capital to make lower tariffs more economically viable?
So, I mean, we put on board, even since 2019 with our Eskom Social Compact, a variety of options to reduce Eskom generation costs. We had proposed that time already, and it's begun to be done, to shift staff, especially management, from the head office to the plants where the real engine is. We've also continued to push to allow Eskom to enter the renewable energy space to help reduce its own generation costs. And of course, we continue to push that more must be done by law enforcement to tackle the corruption, the vandalism, the cable theft, which are a huge part of the leakages at Eskom.
But none of
I
those are
think
short-term solutions, are they?
they're all long-term solutions, and we've got to deal with it, to be honest. And these are not easy things. And the major long-term solution we have to do, again, is to harp on it. We've got to move towards a prepaid electricity meter system. So these are all long-term solutions. Our short-term solution, which we had managed to get achieved, was the debt relief package for Eskom, the 253 billion rand. But again, that's only sustainable if you deal with the longer-term, much more hard issues. If you don't deal with them, in 5 years' time, Eskom will need another debt relief package, and that's something the fiscus can't afford. It could do it once off, it couldn't do it every year. So for us, ultimately, this is going to have to be about biting the bullet. We've got to deal with it, and that means we've got to, show some political will. We've had complaints about Eskom workers, municipal workers going out to communities, trying to disconnect illegal connections and getting their lives threatened with, as a consequence. So we also have to see support from the police, for example, to do that. It does require society too also to come to the party and, abide by the basic principles of the rule of law. If you want electricity, you've got to pay for it. But also, we have to be smart about it. There is the high levels of poverty and so forth. And we've seen in many municipalities, the free allocation of water and electricity to indigent households has been quietly deleted by municipalities, and they abandoned, etc. If more of us paid, it means we could not only reinstate that free electricity and water where it's been forgotten, but actually increase the amounts. So I think for us, this is about the longer term things. We've done the short term things like debt relief, etc., appointing competent management and so forth. Now we've got to start dealing with the harder issues, but
All
those
right.
are the fundamental
I
solutions.
just need a quick answer to this. If government fails to act, what is your next move? How much pressure are you prepared to apply?
Well, our next step would be through NLEC to do a Section 77 certificate, which is a strike certificate. We've already put in place some of those motions, which has helped to unlock NLEC engagements. Ultimately, that's always our port of last resort, but we have to have it as a plan B to push government to come with a solution. We just don't have the luxury of giving up on this fight, not when so many jobs are at stake.
COSATU's parliamentary coordinator is Matthew Parks. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africans have swiped their way through something like R1 billion abroad in just 6 months ago. That's according to some fascinating new data from Capitec, showing a sharp 24% jump in international card payments compared to last year. I think it's a useful snapshot of how we travel, where we spend, and how much value we place on convenience. With no conversion fees and zero international payment charges, Capitec says it's positioning itself as the go-to bank for travelers. Well, let's explore this all in a little more detail. Joining me now is Francois Vivier, who is Group Executive Marketing and Communications at Capitec. Francois, a very warm welcome to you. R1 billion in just 6 months is a big number. How much of that is driven by a small group of wealthier travelers versus a broader customer base?
Good afternoon, Jeremy and listeners. This is an interesting trend. We've been monitoring our transactions quite closely, and we were quite excited with our latest financial results to be able to see how, even though our client base has grown by 8%, our number of transactions on digital spend has increased significantly, and notably out of that is digital transactions across borders. So this is both in our neighboring countries and in long-haul destinations like the United States and the UK. And this is not just a number of wealthy clients. This is actually a lot of them, from clients who traveled to Mozambique or Zimbabwe or Botswana, Lesotho or Eswatini. And those are, you know, generally spent for people traveling home or people traveling to see family or people traveling as tourists, as well as people traveling to the US and the UK who typically spend a lot more. What's really exciting about these numbers is that we've also seen a shift from cash transactions, so cash withdrawals at ATMs, towards card payments. And naturally, our Capitec debit and credit card is a MasterCard, which means it's accepted pretty much all around the world. And this is showing that people are thinking differently about how they spend overseas. You know, the days of traveling with a stack of dollars in your pocket has changed, and people are now using their card to do so.
It's interesting, Francois, the debit cards, if I read this correctly, still dominate international transactions. It does suggest, though, that South Africans are cautious travelers. Or do you think that credit is just too expensive for people?
It's probably a bit of both, but we also know that out of Capitec's 25 million clients, only about 1.4 million of them have credit card or have credit, and only about 700,000 or 800,000 have credit cards. So it's also a function of the mix of our client base. And typically people with credit cards are the ones who have qualified for credit cards and therefore use it for their transactional spending. But I think it's important to note that the benefit we offer for international travel is not just on credit cards. It is on debit cards as well. And the big part of that, and you mentioned it in your intro, is most people don't realize when they travel overseas with a card and they swipe their card, the bank might charge a fee on that transaction. And we used to charge a R3 fee, which we've now waived since the 1st of October. So it's absolutely free. But the part that people don't see is that the banks take a commission on the exchange rate. And typically that's about 2.5% to 3%. And in our case, Capitec doesn't do that. So when you swipe your card overseas for a dollar-based transaction, you will get the exchange rate that Capitec gets on the day with no commission on top of that. And that's where we said, well, if our clients spent R1 billion traveling overseas in the last 6 months, and they saved 2.5% by not paying that exchange rate commission, we've effectively saved them R25 million just in these 6 months, and we see that number growing very fast.
It's interesting, isn't it, that regional travel seems to be gaining a degree of momentum. This reveals something, doesn't it, about our relationship now with neighboring markets?
That's definitely true. But we also think there may be a shift of regional travel, which used to be a very, very much cash-based, that has moved towards electronic transactions. So it's a combination of both of those. But and what's quite interesting is, if we look at the age groups of people traveling, you know, typically this international card spend is done by people between the ages of 35 to 44. That's the largest segment. And then in the next segment is 25 to 34. So it's also a younger group of clients that are showing this international travel behavior.
Do you think your data is maybe a broader barometer of South Africa's current state of economy?
We definitely think so. Again, if you reflect on 25 million active clients, it is really a large sample of the economy, and our client base really reflect the cross section of the South African population in terms of our representation across all income and age bands. So it is a very good barometer of what people are doing and where we see growth. And in that regard, if we extrapolate that across the whole population, it definitely indicates a trend of both increasing cross-border spend, but also increasing spend on card.
You talk very positively about zero conversion fees and lower transaction costs. And Francois, bold moves, but the obvious question, I guess, is how sustainable is a model like this in the long run?
It is completely sustainable. Capitec's philosophy in terms of pricing has always been to make our solutions and our products as affordable as possible. And wherever we can use technology and scale to bring down prices, we pass that value back to our clients. We do not do promotional pricing. So this is not a promotion that's here today and gone tomorrow. This is our consistent pricing, and it is 100% economically both sustainable for us as a business, but we think actually really in the best interest of our clients. Most people see the fees they pay, but they don't. It's very difficult to see the commission you pay on an exchange rate. And that's why we're driving awareness of this, because people should interrogate that and should see what is the commission they pay when they do a transaction in a different currency. And we are very transparent about the fact that we don't take that commission.
Just a final one, and maybe more philosophical, beyond Capitec, is there a broader role, do you think, that banks should or can be playing in helping more ordinary South Africans access travel, not just top earners?
I definitely think so. And this is not just travel for international travel, but also local travel. Banking and transactions and payments are really the enablers of people's lives. And things that are important in people's lives is their family, their education, their career, their home, but also travel. And some cases that travel may be for holiday, but in most cases it is to connect with family or it is for business. And if, as banks, we have the ability to both give clients a better option or negotiate better deals on their behalf and make it easier for them to pay for that travel, but also to do so in a very secure and safe way, then that's the role that we can play to enable them to do that.
That's where we're going to leave it. Francois Vivier, thank you very much indeed. Group Executive for Marketing and Communications at Capitec. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa is bracing for a wet and stormy summer. Forecasts from the South African Weather Service indicate above normal rainfall across much of the country, bringing with it the possibility of heavy downpours, thunderstorms, and localized flooding. And I would suggest the implications stretch far beyond just getting caught in the rain. This is going to have an impact on agriculture, infrastructure, water systems, and general disaster preparedness. So joining me now to discuss what is ahead is Letlhakane Tobela, a meteorologist at the South African Weather Service. A very warm welcome to you. So what's driving the shift then towards a wetter summer? And maybe just tell us how unusual it is compared to previous years.
Good morning and thanks for the invite. I mean, I think we'll have to start with just a general sense of a seasonal forecast with what you expect in the eastern parts of the country in summer. Generally expect some warm to hot conditions, some increased humidity, especially along the escarpments as well as the coastal areas. And this has been the past climate over the eastern and central parts of the country once we get to summer, especially once we start ending off transition season, which is spring, once we move into the hotter days, which is summer. Then we then generally have some warm temperatures, hot temperatures in some places, with the moisture then being available and part of that being triggers, we have more thunderstorms as well as a peak season for rainy season. And this typically occurs between December all the way to February. Now, what to expect currently, the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is what we refer as ENSO, is what we use to measure whether we're going to move into El Nino or La Nina. El Nino being when we're expecting below normal rains with hotter temperatures, but La Nina and the other side of things is when we're expecting above normal rains. The temperatures will also be less hot than what you expect with El Nino, but with the current seasonal forecast, we're expecting above normal temperatures as well as above normal rains, especially over the central as well as the eastern parts of the country. It is kind of still being under the weak La Nina season, but it's also still introducing more conditions that are expected to be above normal rains, especially over areas over the Free State, the Northwest, into parts of Gauteng, Mpumalanga, Limpopo, as well as moving into KwaZulu-Natal and the eastern half of the Eastern Cape.
And compared to previous years, what does the picture look like?
I mean, different years bring different conditions in terms of El Nino or La Nina. The past years, we've had La Nina being weak and we've had above normal rains. At some point, we've had La Nina for three consecutive years where we had received more of the rain. But there was a year just after we've had three consecutive La Nina years, we had El Nino, which then lasted for about a year or two, which then resulted in more of extreme weather conditions, because you would know that with an increase in temperatures and hot temperatures in the eastern part, it then also assists in more of extreme weather conditions, especially of violent thunderstorms as well as heavy rain in some instances when we have different weather systems. Currently, we are in a weak La Nina, and we've been from a La Nina season where we're expecting more rain. But for this seasonal forecast, it is still under weak, but we have a percentage of about greater than 60% chance that is still alluding to a La Nina then being comfortably with between December all the way to February. That's where we're going to expect more of these heavy rains as well as a possibility of more thunderstorms. So the thunderstorms are more expected in the afternoons, and that's why the South African Weather Service will continue to monitor as well as issue now casting as well as warnings ahead to make sure that the public is better prepared.
Can we talk a little bit about the storm activity and what's expected? Are we talking about more frequent showers or more intense damaging systems?
Yeah, so once we speak about systems, there are weather systems called cutoff low weather systems, which then in a study that was done by Dr. Mary Jane Bopapi and other communities, as well as including some people from the South African Weather Service, it was then alluding that the cutoff low weather systems are yet to bring much more of the major contributors to extreme rainfall in the eastern part of the country. But this was the observation that was also done based on the disaster management database, and they noticed that with more of having cutoff low weather systems, it then results in more of severe weather in the eastern parts. I mean, you'd remember what happened in KwaZulu-Natal as well as parts of the Eastern Cape. These were conditions due to cutoff low weather system. Now, once we move into summer, yes, we are characterized with rain as well as thunderstorms, but with it having more of the extreme weather conditions expected in the eastern parts, the weak La Nina season then increases the above normal rains, but it's not only based on weather systems. We'll have severe thunderstorms that will occur due to heat, but once we have weather systems like a cutoff low, or we have a continental tropical low pressure system that is bringing about more moisture in the eastern parts, it then triggers more of the severe thunderstorms and as well as more of the heat then that's helping in the escarpments uplift. That's when we have more storms. So with the storms, you can expect severe thunderstorms that will bring excessive lightning, more thunder, more hail, as well as large amounts of small hail and a possibility of strong winds. We've already observed tornadoes in some parts of Gauteng in the past 2 weeks, and that is part of the severity that I'm talking about. So once you speak of a severe thunderstorms, you're speaking of characteristics of damaging winds, a lot of wind shear that will result in more of the gust, as well as possibility of storms that bring about large amounts of small hail or large amounts of hail. And if it's quite more of being extreme, it will result in more conditions like a tornado.
So let me ask you about consequence very quickly. Could this increased rainfall bring some relief to drought-stricken regions? And it's obviously going to have an impact on water infrastructure such as dams, stormwater systems, and even catchment areas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you did geography, you would understand you had different, you would have a system or say an exam question that would always ask, when would rainfall be a blessing or a curse? And in this time, we'd speak of but heavy rains that results in damages. But as much as we speak of damages, it also plays a role in making sure that our river systems are having more water for it to be generated and more people to still have more access to the water. But with what we're expecting in this season, above normal rain then speaks of more rainfall than average what you would get in the summer season, which then would say is that we'll have more water excess, especially over the eastern parts. It should cover KwaZulu-Natal, the eastern parts of the Free State, into the Eastern Cape and parts of Gauteng, as well as Mpumalanga. But the, climatologically, you would understand that the further north you go off South Africa, the more drier it gets. So with areas around Limpopo, yes, you'd have severe thunderstorms, but you're getting to a point where an area that has been been arid and more of resulting to almost close to drought, having some more of thunderstorms, it may also cause some damages, because you'll have an area that's quite dry already that will have more of the storms bringing rain, which may also result in some flash floods. So it's not only just that we're going to bring rain, but it will obviously have some consequences in some areas. For areas where obviously it's already understood that we're going to get more of the rain, then the infrastructure starts to adapt, and obviously the disaster management people will start to act in a way that will help us be more measurable in terms of how we adapt to the more of the extreme weather conditions, because it's definitely putting a toll on the infrastructure. Yeah. The more we have these weather systems that are bringing more of these severity in terms of weather conditions.
Thank you very much indeed for the overview. That's Lehlonolo Tobela, meteorologist at the South African Weather Service.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's first responders are facing a deepening mental health crisis. On average, one member of the South African Police Service dies by suicide every week. In just the past year, 54 officers have taken their own lives, part of a rising seven-year trend that has claimed something in the region of 300 lives. Now, behind the uniform, paramedics, firefighters, doctors and emergency workers, I would contend, are struggling with depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress and burnout at levels far higher than your eye, the general population. In that respect, I want to talk now to Dr. Stacey Usch, who is a member of the South African Society of Psychiatrists. She joins me to discuss what's driving the crisis and what can be done to those who protect us. Stacey, a very warm welcome. Let's start with police. The number of suicides rising sharply, it's worrying. What do you think is driving the surge among them, and maybe more broadly among first responders?
There really seems to be quite a serious lack in mental health resources for the first responders. And due to their constant exposure to very stressful circumstances that deplete them emotionally, physically, this exacerbates existing mental health difficulties that they may suffer with, just like the rest of the population. A very significant lack in these mental health support structures for these workers makes it quite difficult for them to access help. And it also lends the question as to whether they also do not seek help because of perceived stigma, as social stigma is definitely exaggerated in uniformed workers.
Is it principally then about a lack of mental health support, or is it just constant exposure to trauma?
Certainly a combination of the two. When we look at the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on the Police, who highlighted its concerns around the lack of adequate employee health and wellness interventions for the SAPS members, there's an interesting statistic where the SAPS management actually advised that 621 health and wellness employees were to service 187,000 SAPS personnel. So certainly that statistic does highlight that there is a discrepancy in the number of healthcare workers that are able to support the SAPS personnel. But certainly there are concerns in the workplace as well.
And that is a very worrying and disturbing statistic. And Stacey, what impact does untreated mental illness have then on operational effectiveness and safety?
Certainly these first responders will have a reduced capacity to foster their own resilience and coping skills, which compromises their ability to carry out their own work. And this is really a crisis in our country, because we can ill afford losing mental health care workers and due to this and due to a lack of mental health care resources. And eventually this will translate into them being unable to care for those that desperately need their help.
Can I circle back to the stigma issue that you raised a little earlier? How does it inside uniformed services compound the problem? How bad is it?
So it's definitely something that I've seen firsthand myself. I think First responders are expected to look a certain way, to be a certain way. And I think that they are expected to have a certain amount of resilience and that they are supposed to be perceived as strong and almost not also allowed to suffer from mental illness themselves, because they're seen as they need to be stronger than that. They need to be seen that they almost have to fix themselves, which is a very unhealthy concept for us to have. But unfortunately, that is a stigma that is pervasive, and I've seen it in the medical community firsthand. And it definitely exacerbates the difficulty in accessing care, because there is a feeling that you shouldn't need to, in a way.
Do you think this crisis has the potential to erode public trust in first responders? And if so, with what consequence?
That's a very interesting question, actually. I think that certainly does. I think we are becoming more and more aware of this crisis amongst workers that are facing burnout and that are working longer hours. I've heard many members of the public voicing concern around the length of the hours that some of the first responders, doctors, ambulance personnel have to work. And there is concern around somebody caring for a critically ill patient, potentially, that has been working a shift over 24 hours. It just feels quite inhumane. So I think in terms of the occupational demands and the lack of resources that they're facing in terms of being able to support their own mental health, I think that there are very warranted concerns in terms of the public and how they would trust these workers.
You've called for, and I quote, confidential, independent pathways, if I've got that correct, to encourage help seeking. What is that, and why would confidentiality be so important? And I suspect it will come back to stigma.
Absolutely. I think it does. It does always come back to stigma. I think people are very concerned about their job security, how they're perceived in their job role. There are concerns around career progression. And it is, unfortunately, despite all the evidence to the contrary, I think mental illness is still seen as a weakness in some way. And that comes circling back to stigma itself. And I do think that that certainly does limit access to care. And again, the employee assistance programs and wellness interventions, we've noted, have had quite significant discrepancies in their quality. And this might also foster reluctance to seek help in the workplace. And there may be actual lack of confidentiality or a perceived lack of confidentiality. There might even be a fear to embark on that journey because of that perceived lack of confidentiality. If there are very clear pathways to preserve the confidentiality of the first responders, and if this is made very clear to them and that they are very aware of this, perhaps this could break that barrier and increase self or help seeking behavior.
Well, whichever way you look at it, those statistics that we've outlined are very disturbing. I've been in conversation with Dr. Stacey Usch, member of the South African Society of Psychiatrists. Stacey, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.